You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret here on the Ideas Network. And coming up, the Biden administration says the COVID-19 public health emergency will come to an end May 11th. A doctor joins us to talk about what that could mean for COVID policies and programs. Now, games are supposed to be fun, but more and more we're seeing aspects of games used in the less fun parts of our lives, like work, school, exercise, even finance. And unlike games that are for fun, if you lose at these games, you can face real-world consequences, and you can't just insert another quarter to try again. This idea of gamification has been on the rise since the early 2000s, and our next guest thinks it has positive uses, but it often goes too far. We're listening back to that conversation now, and you can still join in by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Do you see examples of gamification in your everyday life? Does your workplace or school have a point system or some type of competitive aspect to it? Do you like it? Do you dislike it? Do you think it has impact? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Hahn is the founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. He's also the author of the new book, You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. He talked with our own Rob Ferret last month. Here's a listen.
Can you start off with sort of a working definition of gamification? What does it mean?
Yeah, it's basically the use of ideas from game design, like points, badges, leaderboards, missions, that sort of thing, for non-game purposes. So for things like education, health, fitness, anything that isn't just about entertainment.
A lot of your book and a lot of our conversation are going to be about the misuse and abuse of gamification. But you don't think it's necessarily bad in and of itself? You use it, for example, in apps you've created. At best, what can gamification help us do?
Well, I think that gamification can help us achieve things that we know we should be doing or we really want to do, like learn a language or, you know, get fit or just learn new concepts. But we find it kind of difficult to do so or really tough. So I think one really fun game out there is called Kerbal Space Program, and it's all about learning physics and orbital mechanics by launching little creatures into space. And it's very accurate, and it's just a great way of learning science. But also, I think there's all sorts of fitness games. You know, a lot of people play Nintendo's Ring Fit Adventure. I used to play Dance Dance Revolution, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, a lot of ways to make boring activities a bit more fun.
Now, let's stay with those self-improvement apps. I find, you know, I've got a fitness tracker. It gets me out going for walks. I do a language one. It keeps me motivated to keep my streak going to learn a language. That's great. But you say sometimes gamification is misused in those self-improvement apps for a variety of reasons. Where do we start to go wrong with those?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned streaks, because I think that's a really powerful motivator for a lot of players. So, you know, a lot of people use Peloton, a lot of people have Apple Watches, and a lot of these are fitness apps and games use streaks to encourage people to work out, you know, 5 days in a row, 10 days in a row, 100 days in a row. You know, you see people showing off their streaks and trying to maintain them even at the expense of their own health. You know, we know that it's not healthy to be exercising when you're ill. Even if you're not ill, it's just good to have rest days when you're running or swimming or cycling. And these streaks, you know, if they're designed in a really simple way, which is how most of them are, if they give people achievements for just working out forever and not taking any rest, they can actually harm you. And that's one example of gamification that is against people's interests.
Talking to Adrian Hahn, his new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use one of these motivational apps that uses leaderboards or streaks, say, or points to reward you and motivate you? Did you stop? If so, why? And how about at your workplace? Are there competitions, productivity challenges, things like that? What do you think about those? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions for our guest. Adrian, let's go to work now. You spend a lot of time looking at how companies are gamifying for better and mostly for worse. First of all, what kind of things are out there if people haven't encountered this at work?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's all over the place. I was amazed and kind of disturbed by how frequent it is. So a lot of people work in call centers now or in customer support, and their interactions with customers are timed down to the second. And if they are not, acting well, or if they're not, being polite enough or just responding quickly enough, then they can have points deducted and they can slip down the leaderboard and not receive achievements. And if they do too badly in this kind of gamified system, then of course they can get punished and get fired. But I think one place which people will be pretty familiar with, one app, is Uber. And a lot of Uber drivers are having their compensation effectively gamified. So periodically, Uber drivers will be invited to choose from different quests. And in these quests, they can sign up to drive 30, 70, 100 trips in a week. And if they achieve the quest, then they get more money. And if they don't, then they lose that. And of course, you could say, well, isn't that a good thing? You know, people like having more money. But if you talk to Uber drivers, which I've done and a lot of people have done, they find it kind of manipulative, because at the end of the day, it's all down to money. And I think they'd rather have more certainty rather than having to hope that they'll be offered these quests and hope that they can really achieve those goals. I think what they'd rather have is just better pay in general. And it's really interesting that they choose to call these things quests, rather than just tasks. And I think part of that is down to the fact that we're all used to thinking that quests and challenges and achievements are good things because we play video games. Everyone plays video games now. And it's really interesting and kind of a bit disturbing to see workplaces take those ideas from video games and try and use them in a way that can exploit people, I think.
Well, and you talk about what ends up being incentivized in that Uber driver's case, and then this can come up with certain truck driver systems too. The incentive might be keep driving, even though you might feel too tired to keep driving. Ultimately, the incentives can lead us in potentially dangerous directions.
Well, exactly. I mean, people from Uber are on record for saying that they want drivers to drive as much as possible. Obviously, they would say that they don't want people to drive dangerously. At the same time, it's not just quests that Uber uses to try and manipulate people. There's all sorts of things, that tricks in the apps, gamification they use to try and get people to move to different areas of the city or just to drive more. And I think that these systems can work in incentivizing people through money or just through visuals to try and get them to do more than they wanted to.
Now, you also look at use of these apps in schools, and I'll get to one of those in a minute, but one of the most amazing quotes from your book is a New York Times article about a classroom game app called Class Dojo. A third grader quoting here, "I like it because you get rewarded for your good behavior, like a dog does when it gets a treat." I mean, that third grade kid, he says a lot there.
Yes, this was one of the most eye-opening things I discovered while researching the book. This comes from an app called Class Dojo, which is used in supposedly 95% of US schools, and it's in schools around the world. And it basically does two things. The first thing is pretty simple. It's like a private social network for teachers, students, and parents, and that's fine. But the second thing is basically, it's an app that gives teachers the ability to reward and deduct points from all the students in their class in real time. So they can go and say, oh, if this kid is acting up or being too noisy, minus 10 points. If they're being quiet, if they are doing teamwork, then plus 20 points. And those points can often be traded in for treats. And again, this is not a new thing. We've had points and we've had badges in schools before. But as that kid says, there is something about the kind of continuous nature and also about the way in which this app works just from an audio point of view, which is really interesting and really different. So in Class Dojo, when you get points deducted, you hear the sad sound from the phone, from the teacher's phone. If you get points awarded, you get this happy sound. And, you know, the kids obviously associate that, you know, with being trained like a dog. And now, of course, you could say, well, this is good if it keeps the classroom under control. But really, is this the way that we want kids to learn in school, to be motivated in school? And I think that's a big question. Some people might say, actually, that's fine as long as kids behave. But I'm sure that a lot of parents would think otherwise.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Racine. Peter, what did you want to tell us about?
So I actually work as a software developer for a manufacturing company, and we use scoreboards like this, this gamification, to motivate workers and to try and, you know, have them work off of each other. It isn't used to alter their pay or anything like that. It's just used to evaluate and address issues where performance does fall or where performance is exceptional. It's one of those things where, in my opinion at least, it's all about the ethics of how it's implemented. You don't want to do exactly what Uber's doing and encourage bad behavior or discourage good behavior because of the way your algorithms report on performance. But it can be used very constructively, at least in my experience.
And Peter, can I ask, how long has this been in place at your workplace?
Some of the scoreboards have been in place for 8 to 10 years now, and some of them we are implementing. It just, you know, every time we find a place where we can utilize it, it's great, but you have to be able to compare people on very even terms, and when you have different roles that don't mesh with each other, it's very hard to compare them.
Interesting. So Peter, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Adrian, what do you think of Peter's example?
Well, I think it's really interesting because we've always had examples of giving feedback to workers in workplaces. And I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, people want to know when they're doing well and when they're doing poorly. And it can be nice having that feedback in real time. I think it really depends on scale. You know, it's hard for me to know whether one case or another case is done well. Certainly in some big organizations, one of the problems that we have with these gamified workplaces is that the only way you get feedback is through this computerized system, this gamified system, and there is no way really to talk to a manager. And it is being done in such a kind of fine-grained surveillance way that even if you slip up once, then that's it. And so that's obviously, I think most people would agree, that's just too cruel. Now, I think there are ways to do this in a way that isn't that doesn't punish people so much. But it really comes down to those rewards and punishments. You know, if the punishment for slipping up a couple of times is you're fired or you're docked pay, then, you know, that's too much. But if it's just, hey, we're going to have a chat, then that's probably okay.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Peter. We're talking to game designer Adrian Hahn about his new book on gamification. It's called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you, like Peter, have something like this going on at your workplace? What do you think about it? How about in your school or your child's school? Have you used Class Dojo or some other behavior reward app like that? What do you think about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Adrian Hahn, founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. His new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or to share your encounters with streaks or points or leaderboards at your work, your school, your exercise app, you name it, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Kevin is on the line in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm a teacher. I have used these points-based systems with students on multiple occasions. Honestly, I do not like them. I think they are teaching kids the wrong idea of doing things for points or for not losing points. And until they internalize that this positive effort leads to positive consequence, they're a very poor crutch. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for sharing that. Adrian, that gets to the heart of a big question here for students and others. What is our motivation? What should our motivation be for doing something like behaving and learning in school?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, he's drawing a distinction between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, you know, where extrinsic motivation would be just trying to get someone to do something by effectively, you know, bribing or rewarding them with sweets or points or trinkets. And, you know, intrinsic motivation, you know, is where we want kids to learn English or learn science because they find it interesting or they find it, you know, engaging or they find it, you know, beautiful. And of course, you know, it's not always the case that kids are going to pick up on that immediately. And it's difficult to do that if you've got, you know, a huge class and you don't have a lot of time to prepare. So I do sympathize, you know, with teachers who do, you know, end up using ClassDojo. I think a lot of them probably would prefer not to. And I think it's a weird situation where I think some kids and some parents actually expect ClassDojo to be used in some places. But, you know, the problem is if you rely on it too much, then the only thing that the kids are trying to do is maximize points. And, you know, that only works for so long.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Wendy joins us now in New Berlin. Wendy, hi.
Hello, Kevin. You just summed up exactly how I feel. I'm a retired teacher, and I got my degree in the 70s, and I think that makes a difference. So I found so many teachers doing these money programs or tokens, and I didn't do it. In fact, I fought against it by doing things like I would bring in a whole tray of chocolate chip cookies. And my students would be like, whoa, what'd we do? You know, and I'd say nothing. I just like you. And that was hard for them to get. It's really, I think it's really seriously a problem. It's scary to me how children are being manipulated. And it is much easier for the teacher, but good luck trying to break that system.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Well, for somebody like Wendy at a school, at a, you know, making decisions at a workplace, you name it, how do you break out of that gamification, negative gamification mentality, Adrian?
I think it's tricky because obviously, you know, if you're just one teacher in a school and you've got, you know, a lot of obligations, it's hard to sort of swim against the tide. Especially, of course, if you're a worker in, you know, Amazon, or if you're a driver at Uber, you know, maybe you don't have a lot of power there. You know, I think as individuals, then, you know, we can try and push back against gamification when we encounter it in our own lives and just be aware of when we're being gamified. I mean, to take, for example, I've got an Apple Watch, and every month it tells me to try and beat my previous month's calorie goal. which is, as you can imagine, it gets increasingly difficult to do that to a point where it's impossible. And it's okay to just turn that off, right? You know, if you see that in your life, if you have an app like Duolingo or you have a watch that says, hey, please try and do more, you can just turn that off because that's not something that you're asking for. I think in schools, yeah, you know, I think I love that note by Wendy talking about just, hey, I'm just giving you these cookies because I like you, rather than, you know, it's a reward or a punishment. And, you know, that's something I try to do in my own workplace, you know, with my employees. I think people like getting positive feedback and they like getting, you know, learning about ways to improve. At the same time, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm just doling out points and badges every, you know, few minutes or every hour, as actually happens in some workplaces now. So, you know, if you're in a position of influence and you can try and change things, if you're just someone who, if you're someone who works at a workplace and you can ask them to change, but in your own life, I think there are places you can turn off gamification if you can.
Wendy, thanks for that call. I also accept chocolate chip cookies, if you like the show. Adrian, you're pitching messages to different audiences here. I want to focus on one, people who design apps and programs and workplace reward systems. What kind of ethical considerations do you want those people to have in mind as they design and then implement these kind of gamified setups?
Well, you know, I have a few different sort of like guidelines for how people can do it well. One guideline that I've mentioned before is really try and keep the rewards and punishments small, right? It's just not, it's not a good system if the punishment is you're fired or you're fined $10,000. It just makes people terrified. to be honest, it's not really a good motivator. And similarly, if you have a prize of $1 million, you know, $10,000 or free college or that sort of thing as the result of performing well in a gamified system, but people are just going to manipulate that. They're going to burn themselves out. They're going to cheat. It's not a way to motivate desirable behavior. I think another thing to do when designing these systems is ultimately to try and keep the customer or the players or the users' best interests at heart. And that is very hard to do. And sometimes, you know, people might say that's paternalist. But, you know, that's something that we just try to do in our own games. We try to think, look, how can we design this in a way that people are not going to be unhappy at us for making them overexercise or unhappy at us at spending more money than they wanted to? And sometimes that can go against the profit motive. And that's just something you're going to have to decide. And not every designer can make that decision, but you can voice your opposition.
That was Adrian Hahn, the founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. He talked with Rob Ferret last month about his new book, You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. Coming up after the news, we talk with a doctor about the end of the COVID-19 public health emergency, set to end May 11th. What will that mean for you and me? I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, the local news industry continues to shrink with industry layoffs and newspapers shutting down altogether. We'll talk to one of the organizers of a new coalition that aims to revitalize local journalism. But now, the Biden administration announced yesterday that it will end the COVID-19 public health emergency on May 11th. Some Republicans are saying that an end to the public health emergency needs to happen now in an effort to save taxpayer dollars. The Biden administration disagrees, saying it's important for healthcare workers to have time to prepare for what will inevitably change COVID policies and reactions to this deadly virus. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. What about declaring an end to this public health emergency? Have your own reactions or opinions toward COVID changed since 2020, if at all? And if you're a healthcare worker, we'd love to hear your perspective this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much, Lee. It's a pleasure joining you this afternoon.
Yeah, the White House said yesterday that the end of the public health emergency coming up in May is a sign that federal officials believe the pandemic has moved on to a new, less dire phase. While the New York Times reports that more than 500 people a day in the U.S. are still dying from COVID-19. What does the end of the public health emergency mean in terms of public health?
Well, I think it's the realization that we have gotten through the worst of this, even though it's going to continue at a low level for quite some time. I think as of today, we've had about 1.1 million people in this country die of COVID, which is huge. That's basically one out of every 300 people in this country. On the other hand, we are seeing the signs of the transition from the pandemic to much more of an endemic situation where this virus becomes part of our annual list of characters that come and visit us. such as influenza and respiratory syncytial virus or RSV. So I think this is just an acknowledgement that we have gotten through the worst, but we still have some challenges ahead.
So if it will become more endemic like influenza, every fall I go to get my flu vaccine, how will this change COVID-19 vaccines without this public health emergency, Dr. Temte?
Well, it shouldn't change things very much.
Okay.
As many of the listeners are aware, these vaccines came through initially with what we called an emergency use authorization, which allowed the FDA to approve the vaccines through an accelerated pathway. However, the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine have now been fully licensed, meaning they've gone through the full usual FDA review. And so along that line, it's not going to change things very much at all. The other thing to keep in mind is that the vaccines that we have all received or have been recommended to receive have been provided free of charge. They've been covered by the federal government. The transition that's going to occur is the vaccines will start being covered by private insurers, by medical assistance, and by Medicare. And so that change will be relatively invisible to consumers and regular people out there, and more noted by the insurance industry.
Yeah, Pfizer and Moderna say their vaccines will cost between $82 and $130, which is somewhere about three or four times, as I understand it, what the government paid. So this could impact those without insurance then maybe the hardest?
That's correct. In this country, any vaccine that is recommended by the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices has to be covered by insurers without any deductible. However, if you're one of those individuals who is totally uninsured, there really isn't any way to pay for it except out of your own pocket.
Dr. Temte, how will this change COVID testing with an end to the public health emergency on COVID coming up in May?
Well, I think the major thing we're going to see is the change from being able to request free home tests or to get a home test that is entirely covered by your insurance company to one that you might have to shell out some money for. There might be a copay, you might have to pay the entire cost. What we have actually seen across the country is a rapid decline in the use of the PCR or polymerase chain reaction tests to the home tests or the rapid tests. And the difference between those two is the home tests, we don't have any mechanism to require people to report the results. So ever since we've made this transition to more and more home tests, we've become a little bit more blind to how much COVID is actually out there. But again, what we're finding is people are less and less inclined to test. We're finding that in general, as people have been vaccinated and as people have had prior infections, the cases become more and more mild and less of the type that people want to know what that result is. So I think this is a reasonable time to make this transition.
Dr. Jonathan Temte, our guest, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we invite you to this conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have some concerns about the end of this emergency declaration coming up in May, or if you're wondering why we haven't declared an end to this emergency already, 1-800-642-1234 if you're in the healthcare sector. Also like to get your perspective this afternoon, and you can also email us ideas@WPR.org. So Dr. Temte, why not end this emergency declaration now? The Republican-controlled House is looking to pass the Pandemic is Over Act, which would end, in essence, this emergency as soon as it would become law. Is there a reason we wouldn't end it now as opposed to May?
Well, I think across the media, you've heard more and more about having an appropriate exit ramp. And I think the thing that we really have to keep into account are the other things with this pandemic that the money and the declaration of an emergency has allowed money to flow. So for example, when the declaration of the end of this occurs, we're going to see a number of people maybe removed from medical assistance, people that might earn a little bit too much but have been kept on because of pandemic funding. For individuals out there with student loans, there have been some people who have had kind of a pause on the repayment schedule. I think really important for a state like Wisconsin is the emergent or the public health emergency allows hospitals to collect some additional money for individuals on Medicare who have COVID. And this has allowed many of our rural hospitals to keep their doors open and keep patient care going. And so there are a lot of things that we need some time for transitioning. I think one other area that we've learned to do, I know that in our clinic we do much more than we ever have before, is the telemedicine visit. And there has been a relaxation of the rules for telemedicine visits during the pandemic. And we need time to kind of adjust and, you know, make new processes so this continues to work into the future.
Let's go to your questions now. 1-800-642-1234, where Kay is standing by. Kay, good afternoon. You're on the air with Dr. Jonathan Tempty.
Hi. I'm wondering if the role of pharmacists is going to change at all, because now they give a lot of immunizations, and I wondered if that's going to change.
Great question, Kay, and thank you. Dr. Tempty?
That is a wonderful question. And in fact, pharmacists are allowed to provide virtually any vaccine, especially to adults. And so I don't see any change coming, particularly with COVID vaccines or with other vaccines. And over the years, we have evolved in the medical community to more and more embrace our colleagues in pharmacy as being really, really important people in terms of helping to get that vaccine out there. We have pharmacies open at well beyond the hours of most of our clinics. They're oftentimes more accessible. So this is one of those good things that I think is going to continue.
Good to hear. And we're talking with Dr. John Tempty, the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, with us to talk about the U.S. announcing the end of the COVID public health emergency, which will happen on May 11th. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. If you're in healthcare, what do you think of the end of the public health emergency? Would you like to see it sooner? Would you like to see it extended? How are you planning on that changing your work or, for that matter, your personal life? 800-642-1234 or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Dr. John Tempty, the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're looking at the announced end of the COVID-19 public health emergency, now set for May 11th. We invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think it's time to end this public health emergency for COVID-19? And what questions do you have about what will change? You can always email us as well, ideas@WPR.org. And Dr. Tempty, I wanted to ask, this end of the public health emergency has been pushed back a few times. Is there any reason to believe it could be or could be delayed again?
This has been a virus that has been fairly unpredictable. However, if we look at the tea leaves out there, being a coronavirus, if we look at our other coronaviruses that we see commonly in Wisconsin, they mostly go away after April or May, and we don't see them again until fall. So my gut sense is that we're going to see low levels of this virus continue on, but perhaps we'll catch a bit of a break during the summertime. So I think, to be honest, in terms of the timing being on May 11th, that's probably an ideal time. And I think we just have to keep our eyes open, keep surveillance systems going, keep our vigilance up to see what happens with this virus. And hopefully we don't see the emergence of a much more harmful virus or a variant out there. But we will be smarter as time goes on.
Let's continue with your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. Jack in Milwaukee, you're on the air with Dr. John Tempty.
Yeah, do you see any funding problem potentially with for the local health departments to continue their programs related to immunization of the disabled and the frail elderly or even those on hospice who may fall through the cracks here? As I understand it, in my own experience, we actually got an elderly parent immunized through staff through a private charity, even though she was on Medicare, on hospice. You have any comments on that?
Jack, I very much appreciate that perspective. And Dr. Tempty, what do we know?
Well, that's really such an important area, Jack. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, Wisconsin ranks either 48th or 49th in terms of public health funding going out to the counties. And people across their 72 counties are public health officers are just devastated from the last 3 years. There has been incredible turnover in terms of personnel. There have been workforce problems, you name it. And so going forward, you're absolutely correct that we will be understaffed, underfunded, and the ability to be able to meet in the homes or in community centers for people who don't have access to care elsewhere. This is a problem that's going to continue as long as we underfund our public health infrastructure and, more importantly, our public health personnel.
Dr. Tempty, what would change with the end of this public health emergency when it comes to mask wearing or other COVID safety protocols? Would any of those change?
Not really. The masking has always been the purview of either a state or a county, or sometimes there is a mandate put on by a school district. We have never had a federal mask mandate except for public transportation. And so I think going forward, we're unlikely to see any of that. And in fact, the experience has been so negative that I think going forward, people are going to be very, very reluctant, even if there is a legitimate purpose, but very reluctant to bring back any mask mandates.
Let's continue with your questions now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Dr. Jonathan Tempty. Chris in Elkhart Lake, good afternoon.
Oh, I was just wondering if once it's dropped down from the rate it's at, whether or not there's going to be mandatory injections or, you know, at works, schools, mostly workplace, that you have to actually be vaccinated to get keep your employment.
Yeah, I think going forward, Chris, that about the only place that you will likely see a mandate for becoming vaccinated for COVID is going to be within the medical profession, in healthcare settings for physicians, for physician assistants, nurse practitioners, for nurses, medical assistants, laboratorians. But outside of that, I really find that very unlikely. In fact, we really don't have any national or statewide mandates for any vaccine outside of K through 12 educational settings. So going forward, I don't suspect we're going to see that. On the flip side, I'm just going to put a plug in that we know without any doubt that the vaccines have been incredibly effective in terms of prevention of death, of hospitalization, and of even if you do come down with COVID, they're effective for preventing long COVID. So there's so many good reasons to get these safe and effective vaccines that I don't think there's going to be any need to mandate.
Thank you, Dr. Tempty. And I do want to follow up with that and ask if with the end of this public health emergency coming May 11th, if there would be any other changes for doctors or nurses or others in the healthcare field.
Well, I think for healthcare settings, the rules are usually evaluated and set up by administrators, by infection control experts, and so on. And you have to keep in mind that in a healthcare setting, we're really responsible to keep those individuals who are coming in to see us and who have underlying medical problems, immunosuppression, and so on. It is our duty to keep them as safe as possible. And if I can prevent one of my patients from becoming ill from influenza or from COVID because maybe I have an infection, that's what I need to do. I need to have that ethical standpoint of protecting those people who are putting themselves at risk by coming to our clinic.
Dr. Tempty, what about Medicare enrollment, which we've seen increase during the pandemic? What would happen at the end of this public health emergency to those who have enrolled in Medicare in the last couple of years?
Well, I think people who enroll in Medicare are enrolling in Medicare either because they hit the appropriate age or because they have an underlying disability. And I don't see that enrollment changing at all. I think where we do see things changing is within the state-run medical assistance program, or Medicaid. And some of the rules for coverage have been relaxed during the declared emergency, and that relaxation may go away for some individuals with the end of the public health emergency.
Do we have a number on that? Because Health and Human Services, this was last August, said up to 15 million could be dropped from Medicaid rolls.
Yeah, that's the number I've actually seen quite recently as well. So across the country, it could be quite a number of people losing that Medicaid benefit and then having to go on to either the private market or one of the Affordable Care Act markets.
So, Dr. Tempty, do we have any idea what the scope of this could mean for Wisconsin, or what Medicaid enrollment might look like in Wisconsin after the public health emergency sunsets?
Yeah, I have not seen Wisconsin-specific numbers at this point in time, so I can't comment.
And moving forward, how do you think COVID should be treated in regard to policy and public policy and overall approach here?
Well, I think this is a virus that, even going back almost 3 years ago, you know, 2.5 years ago, I told people that I respected influenza, a virus that I've studied most of my career, and COVID scares me. Mm. And I haven't changed very much on that. As of this past Friday, the CDC indicated that maybe 17,000 people had died this entire influenza season, and we're just about done with influenza now. So 17,000 across the country, and that compares to, you know, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 people dying each week in the United States of COVID. And that has been going on since the beginning. And I think we're going to unfortunately continue to see hundreds of deaths on a daily basis across this country for at least the foreseeable future. So I think going forward, we still have to have a great deal of respect of COVID, with the knowledge that there are things that we can do to limit its danger.
Dr. Tempty, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
And thank you so much for having me. Have a good day and keep healthy.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to take a look at the end of the public health emergency for COVID-19 coming up May 11th. Did a computer write this? Microsoft is investing billions in the artificial intelligence called ChatGPT. It can create new complex content from basic human input. Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported that the website BuzzFeed is planning to use a version of ChatGPT to write some of their content. ChatGPT has just passed an Ivy League MBA exam at the Wharton School of Business. Real estate agents are using ChatGPT to write their property listings. The first AI legal defense was scheduled for February in California until multiple state bar associations pointed out that ChatGPT doesn't have a law degree. ChatGPT has now written a speech given by a congressman on the U.S. House floor, and a Massachusetts state lawmakers used ChatGPT to draft a bill to regulate itself. I tried to get ChatGPT to write this, but sadly it was too busy with everybody else. But I did find some music written by Google's artificial intelligence. Yeah, this is Central Time.